Bienvenue to Battle Royale, where we are passing judgment on all the kings and emperors of France, from Clovis to Napoleon III.
Who will be... Oh my god, I just mental blanked on it.
Who'll be selected?
Who'll be selected as the creme de la creme, and who'll be sent to the guillotine?
Je m'appelle Ben Clark.
And I'm Eliza Summers.
And today, we are not doing a king or emperor.
Woo!
We are not even doing a queen, really.
What?
We're doing...
a mystical entity. No, I'm joking.
A mystical entity. We're doing the mother of a king.
Nice.
But she is not herself the queen, as much as she might like being called the queen. We're doing Louise of Savoy, who is the mother of King Francis I, our next king.
Okay.
But I thought it was important to do his mother, first of all, as she is often referred to as the Great Regent.
Ooh.
She plays a very important role in his reign. So before we get into that, got one person to welcome to Patreon.
Okay.
We have one person this week. Erin Jobe. So welcome to the boudoir.
Yay.
And on the boudoir, the first of Francis's official mistresses is going to be out the week the week after this episode comes out.
Nice.
So look out for that one. Shall we get straight into Louise?
Sure, let's do that.
So she was born on the 11th of September, 1476, at the Chateau de Pontin, not far from Geneva, in the Duchy of Savoy. Do you remember where Savoy is? Well, I've kind of given it away.
I'm going to say completely wrong direction. Every time I always just want to say north. I have no idea why.
No, it is not north.
I know. I know it's not north, but so anytime you ask me where something is, I instinctively am like, north. I don't know why, even when I know it's not north.
I was about to say it's north of where you are, but you're in Japan, so it's actually south of where you are. But it's basically southeastern France, western Switzerland.
Okay, nice.
Yeah, modern day is what is the Duchy of Savoy. So Geneva is the capital of Savoy.
Okay.
Louise is born not far from there. So
nice.
Before we get into it, let's do an etymology for her name.
Yay!
So Louise, you won't be surprised to learn, is the feminine form of Louis.
Yeah.
Which is the same as the Frankish name Clovis, which means glorious warrior. So Louise of Savoy was most likely named after her grandfather, Duke Louis I of Savoy. I guess her dad really wanted a son.
He's like, I've already chosen this name. Let's just add an A, basically, and we'll be good to go.
Yeah. It is actually a tradition in some cultures. If the firstborn is a daughter, she's named after not the grandmother, but the grandfather. I guess because they wanted a boy as the first.
Don't they always?
But yeah, up to this point, Louise is not a super common name that we've come across very much. Names like Louise, names like Charlotte, like feminine forms of popular male names, now kind of just becoming a thing.
Okay. Nowadays there's so many Charlottes and Louises.
And guess who helps popularize the name Louise? Is this Louise?
She does.
Yeah. So as well as her father and grandfather being Dukes of Savoy, Louise's mother, Marguerite de Bourbon, was a descendant of both the Dukes of Bourbon and the Dukes of Burgundy. But sadly, her mother wasn't around very long. She died when Louise was 7 years old.
Aww.
Louise's father, Duke Philippe, meanwhile, was a very neglectful father. He hadn't really liked Marguerite, and as a result, he wasn't very fond of either Louise or her little brother, Philibert. Brilliant name.
Yes, it really is. I do like that name. Philibert!
It's like they nearly named him Philip, but then they got lost on the way, so it's Philibert.
I was thinking Albert and Philip mixed together.
Yeah.
Philibert, little Bertie.
There's also another member of the Savoy family who's like the feminine version of that, so her name's like
Philiberta. Of course. When you want to feminize it, put an A on.
Exactly. Or an E in the case of French.
True.
So Philippe, Duke Philippe, so daddy, was more interested in his mistress and his new young wife, Claudine de Brosse, who gave him way more children. And because the Duke of Savoy was rather strapped for cash, he also couldn't afford to keep his mistress, his wife, her children, and his children from his previous marriage in a state of comfort. So he ended up sending Louise and Philibert away to the French court to be raised there. So Louise was actually placed in the household of none other than Anne of France, who, having married into the Bourbon family, was actually Louise's aunt through marriage.
Oh.
Now, at this point, Anne had just become the ruler of France in all but name on behalf of her little brother, Charles VIII.
Mm-hmm.
And Anne was a busy, busy woman. So she didn't necessarily have time to be a kind of mother figure for Louise. Yeah. So Louise continued to be sort of neglected and starved of parental affection, unfortunately. And that's something that she'd maybe spent her whole life overcompensating for when it came to her own children. But Louise did thrive intellectually at Anne of France's court, which, if we remember, had a big emphasis on the education and the moral instruction of young women. If you remember, Anne wrote a whole book on the subject.
Yeah.
And Louise also had an important spiritual mentor in the form of a friar named Francesco de Paula. He was a popular and widely renowned mystic who Louis XI had brought to the French court to give him the last rites when he died. So he just kind of like hung around the court after that, and he spent his remaining years in France. It's with this education under her belt, but not much in terms of wealth or connections, that Louise, at the age of 13, was foisted onto 29-year-old Charles de Valois, Count of Angoulême.
Okay. Ugh, that age gap.
Now, Angoulême belonged to the cadet branch of a cadet branch of the House of Valois.
Branch of a branch.
Yes. So he was the Duke of Orléans' first cousin.
Okay.
And the King of France's second cousin.
Okay.
So he's just further down the line, basically. But because of the Salic law, excluding all the women, and because there are very few male heirs in the Valois family at this point, Angoulême is actually second in line to the throne.
Ooh. Well, it's kind of like Japan.
Yes.
Except for in Japan, if you marry a commoner, you get kicked out.
There are countries that still have Salic law or whatever the local equivalent of it. So it's basically Charles VIII and then the Duke of Orléans, who's the future Louis XII, and then it's this guy, the Count of Angoulême. So given his status, Angoulême, like his cousin, the Duke of Orléans, had always felt hard done by, by guess who?
The spider.
The universal spider. Yeah. He'd never given him the income and honours that he thought he deserved. He frequently worked with kind of rebellious aristocratic factions, and he had tried to secure a marriage that would gain him more wealth and power. At one point, he tried to marry Mary the Rich, the heiress of Burgundy and Flanders. And Angoulême was actually the one lord in France that Mary was actually considering.
Oh, wow.
But Louis XI feared the ambition of his cousin. He forbade the marriage.
Squelched
and this
that.
Backfired spectacularly when Mary then went off and married a Habsburg instead of a French lord.
Yeah.
She married Maximilian.
Come on.
So Angoulême had then tried to marry none other than Anne of Brittany.
That was squashed.
But yeah, this time Anne of France stood in the way. She prevented this marriage because she thought it'd be better if her brother married Anne of Brittany, which he did.
Closer in age too.
Yeah. And this is part of why Anne of France like flung Louise of Savoy at Angoulême and is like, nope, you're marrying her instead. This insignificant little twerp that I got
in my household.
In my care. But little did any of them know that little Louise would end up succeeding and even surpassing her mentor Anne of France as the most powerful woman in the kingdom.
Ooh.
So as the new Countess of Angoulême, Louise moved to Angoulême, which is a very picturesque region, town in Aquitaine.
Okay.
And she mainly dwells at the Chateau of Cognac, which is nearby. And yes, that is where Cognac, the drink, comes from. So she's getting wasted all the time at Cognac. Life in Cognac was a lot more like lively and fun than it had been at the French court at Amboise.
Mm.
So Louise's husband was frequently away doing war and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But she enjoyed the company of his two mistresses, Antoinette de Polignac and Jeanne Leconte. They were already there in Cognac when she arrived, and they kind of like took Louise under their wing. Yeah. And, like, showed her the ropes.
She's a little teen.
Yeah, they also managed the Count's castle while he was away. Antoinette was the chatelaine, the female castellan.
Yeah.
So they helped her learn how to manage her new estate.
Well, that's nice of them.
Yeah, and they became two of her closest friends. They continued to stay with her for basically the rest of their lives.
That's quite sweet.
It is quite sweet. It's very different from how things are done at the French court. So Louise's children in their early years were raised very harmoniously alongside the three illegitimate daughters that the mistresses had between them. And Louise first gave birth at the age of 15 to a healthy girl who she named Marguerite after her mother.
Aww.
Then a couple years later, the day after Louise's 18th birthday in 1494, Louise gave birth to an equally robust boy. And while she'd been trying for children, Louise had sought guidance from Francesco de Paola, the mystic friar, who actually gave her a prophecy that her child would become king of France.
No offense, but that prophecy is probably pretty easy to make. There weren't that many options.
But at this point, Charles VIII is still on the throne. He's having children with Anne of Brittany, some of whom are sons.
True.
Like, could easily not happen. It's by no means considered inevitable at this point. And it's actually kind of freakish that this child does end up becoming the king of France. Spoiler alert. But as a nod to this prophecy, Louise named her child after Francesco de Paola, baptizing him as Francois, or in English, Francis. It's also fitting that his name literally means French or Frankish. And believe me, he will be the most French king that we've ever seen.
Oh, I love that.
So, the joy of bearing a son with such a portentous future was followed by tragedy the following year when Count Charles of Angoulême went out riding in the winter cold and he contracted pneumonia.
Oh, that's different. Usually it's just thought it's going to be another horse falling.
No, he didn't fall off. So Louise was at her husband's side throughout the entire illness. She did everything she could to nurse him back to health. But he died on New Year's Day, 1496. And while Louise hadn't necessarily, like, loved him, they had been, you know, close. He had treated her very well. So she was devastated at his death.
Aww.
And this made Louise a widow at the age of 19.
Wow. Damn, yeah. That's young.
And guess who she decided to marry next?
Who?
Nobody!
Yay!
Trick question.
Yeah, I was thinking, I don't remember anyone.
Louise remained a widow for the rest of her life. And this wasn't for lack of suitors. Both Ferdinand of Aragon and Henry VII of England both offered to marry her at a certain point.
Wow.
When they became widowers. But Louise's only priority is her son, Francis.
Fulfilling the prophecy.
Fulfilling the prophecy. And bringing a stepfather into the mix could potentially, you know, usurp him.
Yeah.
Or like, you know, muddy the waters.
Create House of the Dragon vibes.
Exactly. And she's like, I've done childbirth twice. I got
That's
lucky with
me.
Both of them. Yeah, it's enough. Let's
not tempt
She's very
fate.
Smart. I think she's very smart to have removed herself from that.
Yeah.
But without a powerful male figure, Louise is in a vulnerable position. So the Count of Angoulême did write in his will that Louise should inherit all of his wealth and property and administer his lands until her son came of age.
Yeah.
But Louise was also left with all of Angoulême's debts as
Of course.
So she couldn't necessarily afford to upkeep his lands. And not only that, but Louise was not deemed by the laws of France to be old enough to become her son's official guardian and wield power on his behalf.
She was barely an adult.
Yeah, she would have to be 25 to be able to, like, do that, apparently. So she appealed to the Honourable Duke of Orleans for protection. After all, her son is within the House of Orleans, so he's kind of the head of their house. And after gaining approval from King Charles VIII, Orleans became Francis's guardian in name, but in practice, Louise was allowed to raise him and continue administering his lands.
Nice.
Things changed, however, when Charles died, hitting his head on the lintel, and the Duke of Orleans became King Louis XII a couple years later in 1498, which in turn promoted Francis from second in line to heir.
Ooh.
He's now the heir of the French throne. So, Louise and Frances were summoned to pay homage to the new king at Chinon, and she was determined to do so in extravagant style. She brought over a richly adorned, brightly coloured procession of courtiers.
Nice.
From, you know, they're from the south of France. They're showing off all of their...
Southiness.
You know, all of their colour. She also brought, as part of her household, her husband's former mistresses, his bastard daughters, as well as a courtier, scholar and advisor named Jean de Saint-Gelais, who was widely suspected of being Louise's lover. So rather than being impressed by this extravagant cavalcade that Louise is bringing to the French court, Louis the 12th, who, if you remember, is a little bit frugal, a little bit, you know, doesn't really like all the extravagance and everything. He kind of is shocked and appalled at this display, and he thinks Louise is living far too lavishly and immorally for the king's liking, considering she's supposed to be raising his heir.
Yeah.
So Louis is like, all right, from this point on, Francis is going to be incorporated more closely into the royal family.
Yeah.
Going to move him into the royal chateau of Amboise. So he's very close to Blois, where Louis lives. And Louis also appoints a new guardian to oversee him. Pierre de Rouen, the Lord of Gier. And Gier also becomes the Marshal of France as well. So he's quite an important, quite an ambitious man as well. And Gier thinks that, you know, by hitching his wagon to Francis, he's going to go places.
Yeah.
And Gier's first act, once he gained control over Louise's household, was to banish Jean de Saint-Gelais, the suspected lover. And he basically gutted Louise's household and, like, replaced them with his own creatures.
Creatures.
So at Amboise, which, by the way, is the very chateau where she grown up under Anne of France, Louise found herself constantly in a tug of war with Gier, trying to control Francis. Louise insisted that both Francis and Marguerite, both her children, that they all sleep in the same chamber together, so they were close by, because basically Louise doesn't trust anyone else. And there's one occasion where Gier sends one of his soldiers to grab Francis and take him out of the chamber.
Like a little jail.
So the soldier's, like, knocking at the door. Louise refuses to answer the door.
No one's home!
So the soldier breaks down the door.
Oh.
Whereupon Louise screamed in rage at him and chased him across the castle.
Oh, that is funny.
Until the soldier reached Gier's quarters and he took refuge there.
Just imagine him, like, running behind Gier being like, ah!
So the king intervened at this point, and he's like, this has gone too far. He did dismiss the soldier that had done that, but he didn't get rid of Gier, so this conflict is still simmering away. Gier wanted to see Francis officially incorporated into the royal family as not only the king's heir, but also his adopted son. And Louis the 12th was already kind of going in this direction. He was giving Francis a huge income of 8,000 livres a year.
Nice.
And he named him the Duke of Valois as well.
Ooh, nice.
Francis was also colloquially referred to as the Dauphin, even though he was never actually officially the Dauphin.
Yeah.
So to legally seal this kind of adoption, Gier plotted to get Louis the 12th's only child at this stage, Claude, married to Francis. And that would be a nice, smooth, you know, transition.
Yeah.
It would also mean, because Claude stood to inherit not only the Duchy of Brittany, but also her father's claims to Milan and Naples, it would also mean that those claims got transferred to Francis as well. But this would require breaking off Claude's current betrothal to the Habsburg prince, Charles of Ghent, the future Emperor Charles V. And if you remember, Anne of Brittany was not very happy about this. She was obsessed with those Habsburgs. Oh, meanwhile, by the way, King Louis and Marshal Gier were also plotting to get Louise out of the way by marrying her off to the Duke of Ferrara in Italy.
Ooh.
Which thankfully never came to anything. Yeah. Mainly because of Gier's downfall. So, the breaking off of the Habsburg marriage and the union of Claude and Francis was opposed not just by Claude's mother, the Queen, Anne of Brittany, but also by Louise. they had this in common. But even though they had this in common, the two of them hated each other. they were always cordial and well-mannered in public.
But behind closed doors.
They'd also both kind of grown up at Anne of France's court, so they'd known each other since they were teenagers, basically.
Yeah.
And they were actually almost the exact same age as well. But, yeah, they despised each other. I like to think of them as fire and ice, where, like, Anne is this, like, cold northern princess, and Louise is this, like, hot-headed, like, southern belle. And, of course, their ultimate political ambitions were very much at cross-purposes. So, you know, Anne of Brittany wanted Brittany to be independent.
Yeah.
She also, you know, wanted to have a son to continue her line in Brittany, whereas Louise doesn't want Anne to have any sons. And actually, Louise kept a journal where she basically, like, secretly rejoices every time Anne has, like, a daughter or, like, a stillborn son. So she's quite, like, secretly vindictive about it.
Yeah, God.
So yeah, these two didn't get along, but they agreed on one thing, which is that they didn't want Claude and Francis to get married. Louise thinks that if Claude gets married to Francis, that means Francis will take Brittany, and she doesn't want that. Mm. And then Louise thinks that Claude is too frail and weak for her boy Francis, and she wants Francis to have a more advantageous foreign marriage.
Oh, okay.
So those are all the reasons. And in 1503, Louis XII fell gravely ill. So Marshal de Gier, if you remember, spilled the beans about his future plans, which not only included Francis and Claude getting married, but also included a plan for Anne and Louise to be joint regents, which is the last thing that they wanted. They were both outraged. Anne, as we know from her episode, ordered Marshal de Gier to be tried in Brittany, as he was a Breton. He was one of her cousins, actually. And wanted him to be sentenced to death for lèse majesté. And when this was refused by Louis XII, and Gier was merely dismissed with a slap on the wrist, Anne moved home to Brittany and was separated from the king for the next 5 years. She threw the world's biggest hissy fit. Meanwhile, everything was coming up Louise.
Yeah, I bet you Louise, when Anne left, she was like, oh yay, no chance of children.
Yeah, not only has Anne left, but Gier has also left.
Ooh.
Yeah. And Louise, by this point, is old enough to be officially her son's guardian.
Ah, nice.
There is another guardian appointed on behalf of Louis XII, but he's nowhere near as meddling as Gier was. So everything's good for Louise, except for the fact that her brother, sadly, her father Philibert, sadly dies at this point. Although Louise does get on with her half-siblings in Savoy, who end up inheriting Savoy. Yeah.
Everything's coming up Louise.
And she probably even hoped at this point that Louis would succumb to his illness and die, but he didn't. So Francis wasn't quite king yet. And Louise's two biggest rivals were out of the way in one fell swoop. In addition, Anne had left behind her daughter, Claude, whom Louise now started to forge a motherly relationship with. Now that it was clear that Claude would marry Francis, you know, Louise is like, let's make the best of it.
Get her on my side, get her to be a good daughter-in-law.
Exactly. And Louise was pleased to see that Claude's health was improving with age. Also, Claude is just the sweetest little angel.
Oh, like, I do love her name.
She did remain rather, like, frail and awkward. She lacked the charisma of her mother, but she had this very, like, sweet innocentness about her. Francis never really cared for her, although they did end up having a lot of children together. But Francis was never, like, you know, in love with her. But Louise was like, she must be protected at all costs.
Aww. That is sweet. So sweet.
And Louise was devastated when Claude later on died in her mid-20s. But she gave Francis 7 children. So she did her duty, I guess.
Yeah.
So as we know, Anne of Brittany returned to court in 1509, but after giving birth to a second daughter, Renee, and a short-lived son, she died of a kidney stone in 1514. At the end, however, Anne of Brittany admitted defeat and reconciled with Louise, declaring her the executor of her will, in the hope that Louise would be a good mother to her daughters and look out for their best interests, which she did, to an extent.
As long as it didn't affect her interests, I'm guessing.
Yeah. Louise didn't follow Anne of Brittany's will to the letter, Anne, if you remember, had tried to make Renee the Duchess of Brittany.
Yeah.
So that Francis wouldn't get Brittany.
Yeah.
But Louise kind of just crosses that out, and she's like, no, Claude's the Duchess of Brittany now. which conveniently makes Francis the Duke of Brittany, along with all of his other titles as well that he's accumulated. And just a year later, upon the death of King Louis the XII, Francis also became King Francis I of France.
Yay!
There was talk of Francis actually marrying Mary Tudor. So divorcing Claude and marrying Mary Tudor, who'd been briefly married to King Louis XII for 12 short weeks before his death. And Claude hadn't had any children at this stage, so Francis thought about divorcing her to marry Mary.
How long had they been married at that point, though, Claude and Francis?
Only a year. They married just after Anne of Brittany died.
I can't be expected to have a child in a year.
Yeah. But Louise berated Francis for considering this, and she was relieved when Mary Tudor eloped with the Englishman, Charles Brandon.
She was like, if you dare hurt my precious Claude, I will not be happy with you.
Exactly. So Francis I was 20 years old when he became the King of France.
I was just about to ask.
Yeah, so not quite as young as I think I implied last episode. So he was actually about the same age as Henry VIII had been when he became King of England a few years earlier.
God, that would be like if my brother became king next year.
I know, it's ridiculous.
Weird.
And like Henry VIII, who had his ambitious grandmother, Margaret Beaufort, Francis also began with a powerful woman behind him.
Nice.
And this was Louise. And he really needed her administrative and courtly experience to help guide him through his early years as king.
Yeah.
Because Francis, while he is very strong, he's very, like, self-assured, he is not necessarily the brightest spark, at least at first. He's still got some learning to do.
Yeah.
And his mother and also his older sister as well, his sister Marguerite, is extremely intelligent.
I love that name, Marguerite.
It's a great name. They kind of help him along in these early stages. So while Francis is really, like, mainly focused on organizing his grand coronation and all of the games and pageantry that he wants to go along with it, Louise, meanwhile, was busy placing the men she trusted in the royal council and consolidating her power as the new queen mother.
Smart, smart.
So, yeah, Louise had prepared for this for years.
Well, yeah, she had that prophecy in handy.
In the months before Louis XII's death, Louise had spent time picking out which chambers she wanted for herself and her friends in the palace.
The king's, like, lying there going, and Louise just comes in and is, like, discussing, like, a plan and being like, okay, I want the bed over here, and I want this move
She's got a measuring tape, and she's, like, measuring the bed that the king is dying on.
Yeah, literally. And, like, putting stickers on, like, rooms, being like, okay, this is blah, blah, blah's room, and this is blah, blah, blah. Stick on that.
It's very much that vibe. And she is very much criticized for how presumptuous she is. But the prophecy comes true, and Francis is the king.
Mm-hmm.
So while he was in France, seducing Mary Tudor, Charles Brandon wrote to Henry VIII telling him that, quote, it is she who runs all, and so may she well, for I never saw a woman like her, both for wit, honour, and dignity.
Oh, wow.
And Francis trusted Louise with everything. He always turned to her for advice before anyone else.
Okay, no, it's fine. I totally do that with my mum. I always ask mum for advice.
Because, of course, she's your mum. Like, you know that
mummy knows best.
Your best interests in heart. And Louise, her entire life is centered around Francis.
Yeah.
She has a pet name for him. She calls him My Caesar. Yeah. And she calls him this way before he becomes king. So. Yeah.
Dropping those hints, planting those seeds.
So, on the military front, Francis does actually have a bit of experience already.
Nice.
As a teenager, he'd already been involved in military campaigns on the French border during the War of the League of Cambrai. And this war had, if you remember, resulted in the French being kicked out of Milan.
Yeah.
So the first thing on Francis's to-do list is to go to Milan, kick out the Sforzas again.
Give them that slap.
While he does that, he decrees agrees that, quote, "We have decided to leave the government of our realm to our well-beloved and dear lady and mother, in whom we have entire and perfect confidence, who will, by her virtue and prudence, know how to acquit this trust."
Did they have children by this stage? Him and Claude when he left?
I don't believe they had. I think Claude might be with child or something.
Okay. Find out next episode.
Yeah.
Louise is like, okay, I'll be in charge. You go off and fight your little battles.
Exactly. As well as this, Louise was also given Angoulême to rule in her own right. Not as countess, but as duchess. So she's got a promotion. And later, Francis also gives her the Duchy of Anjou. So double now Louise is not only ruling on behalf of her son, she's also a double duchess. She's an official feudal power base in her own right.
Yes.
So joyful news came in September 1515, when mere months after he'd ascended the French throne, Francis won a glorious victory against Massimiliano Sforza at the Battle of Marignano.
I do like that name, though. Massimiliano. Good name.
Massimiliano.
It's a very good Italian name.
Yeah, he's named after Maximilian Habsburg, I believe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they Italianized it.
They Italianized it, exactly. And this allowed Francis, after defeating the well-named Massimiliano, to regain control of Milan. We'll be getting more into this war in Francis' episode and all of his wars. but Louise did play a part in this victory. Her connections in Savoy helped negotiate a peace with the Swiss. Which allowed Francis to keep hold of Milan, because if you remember before, the Swiss kind of just turned against them and took it back. And after this, Louise also helped negotiate the, quote, Treaty of Perpetual Peace between France, England, and the Empire. The word perpetual is doing a lot of heavy lifting there. There were actually multiple treaties of perpetual peace throughout Francis' reign. But yeah, I'll be skimming over Francis the First's reign as we get into it in far more detail in this episode. I'm now skipping over a number of huge events like the Field of Cloth of Gold, as well as the unification of Spain and the Empire under Charles V, which is, you know, bad news.
They love to be in charge of naming battles.
Oh, Field of Cloth of Gold is not a battle. It's a big peace conference between England and France.
That has been such a cool battle name, though.
But it is portrayed in, I believe, episode 2 or 3 of The Tudors. Including a historically inaccurate wrestling match between Henry VIII and Francis I.
Oh, yeah. No, it was a good, though. I do like the names of treaties as well back in the day. These days, treaties, they were such boring names.
There is another treaty this episode that has a nice name.
Yay.
So, yeah, we'll be skipping over those events. We'll get into them in more detail in Francis' episode. But for the purposes of this episode, we're skipping forward to 1521, so 6 years into Francis' reign, when after years of internal peace, there is an internal crisis that flares up in France over the inheritance of the Duchy of Bourbon, which is a vast territory in sort of south central France. And Louise is at the center of this conflict.
Oh.
If you remember, Anne of France's husband, Pierre de Beaujeu, became the Duke of Bourbon later in life. Yeah. And then he passed the duchy to their only child, Suzanne. Anne and Pierre fought very hard to get Suzanne this inheritance, because it was unprecedented at this point for a girl to inherit a royal duchy. It should have gone by Salic law to her cousin, Charles of Montpensier. But they kind of resolved this issue by marrying Suzanne and Montpensier together.
Yeah.
By the way, I will be calling Montpensier Monty for this episode.
Okay.
I like to call him that.
I dig it.
But Suzanne and Monty didn't have any kids. So this kind of just like kicked the ball down the road for a new succession crisis. Because when Suzanne died without any children, the next nearest heir, in terms of like proximity of blood, was none other than her first cousin, Louise of Savoy.
Oh.
Yes. Who at this point is the only child of Marguerite of Bourbon.
Yeah.
Suzanne's aunt on her dad's side. So now it's between Monty and Louise.
Ooh.
Now there is a suggestion from later historians that Louise may have considered marrying Monty to once again resolve the dispute. But Louise is 45, Monty is 30.
Yeah, he didn't.
So, like, he probably wasn't into it. And there is a story that he, like, spurns her advances and, like, she goes into a rage and, like, that's how the conflict kicks off. But more likely, Louise was still not interested in getting married.
Yeah, probably felt like she was marrying her son.
Yeah. And she simply wanted to destroy Monty so that she could get the duchy for herself and Francis. That's the more likely motivation rather than, like, a woman spurned.
Yeah.
It's just she just wanted this duchy because it's a powerful duchy. I think that's reason enough.
I want it. I'll get it.
And she didn't, you know, she didn't want to get married to Monty. Monty was already the Constable of France, so the leader of the French military. He was the governor of Milan on behalf of the king. He'd been instrumental in the victory at Marignano, so he was a great military commander.
Yeah.
And he controlled like a third of France. So he was very powerful. He needed to be taken down a peg.
Yeah. She is not compromising.
Under the instruction of Louise, Monty started to find that doors at the French court were being slammed in his face. He was no longer getting the royal favour that he was before. Ooh. So Monty, you won't be surprised, decided to rebel.
Of course.
And he actually left France and he teamed up with the Holy Roman Emperor, Charles V, to try to invade France. And he also plotted with Henry VIII, who was also invading France at this point. Henry VIII invades France a number of times. You just have to get used to that as, like, background noise.
When he's bored, he's like, it's a bit boring lately. I know what we'll do. Let's go invade France.
Henry tries to invade France, like, at least three times.
See, it's his, like, go-to way to resolve boredom.
Yeah, Henry VIII just really wants to be Henry V.
Yeah, and that ain't happening.
So, yeah, eventually this issue kind of resolved itself in 1527 when Monty died in battle.
Knew you were going to say that when he died.
Unrelated to France. He actually died in battle against the Pope. But that's a story for another time.
That is.
And with Monty died the last of the great feudal princes of France. The kingdom is now almost completely centralized on an unprecedented level. All of the major duchies are held either by Francis or by Louise. And Louise gets to incorporate much of the Bourbon lands now into her personal territory.
Nice.
So, simultaneously with this conflict, Francis I was also involved in a war against the Holy Roman Empire, which did not end quite as well.
It is the Holy Roman Empire.
And since the fighting meant he had to cross the Alps to Italy once again, Louise was once again left as regent of France in 1524. This time, the news that came home from Italy was not as good as before.
Yeah. It feels like any time you mention the word Alps, it's never good news.
Well, it was before with the Battle of Marignano.
I know, but they're always, there's so many times, I mean, in history, when anytime they mention, like, going over the Alps, I'm like, oh.
Yeah. This time, Francis loses Milan, and he's captured by Charles V at the Battle of Pavia. And he becomes the first reigning king of France to be captured in battle since John II.
Yeah,
and his lovely holiday in London.
Yes.
And Francis gets an even more lovely holiday. Oh! He goes to Madrid. Isn't that lovely?
Nice. I wonder if he enjoyed it as much, though, as John did.
He absolutely did not enjoy it. Francis hated it.
He's like, I don't understand this tapas.
Although he does later, in his later palaces that he builds, they are actually inspired by the royal palace in Madrid. So he is taking notes when he's there.
Yeah.
But things are pretty bad for France, which, if you remember, France kind of just falls apart if the king isn't there.
Yeah.
Louise, meanwhile, she continues having to fight a defensive war against the empire and against England. She has to bribe a lot of French nobles into staying on her side. So the treasury is just hemorrhaging money at this point. Yeah. And Louise really needs Francis back. But throughout his imprisonment, Francis sent letters back to France. A, making it clear that his mother, Louise, was in charge. So, like, obey her. Otherwise, you will feel my wrath when I come back. Francis also sent orders to his mother to, under no circumstances, cede any territory to the empire in order to...
Yes! It's like, do not give her an inch.
But Louise was in very desperate circumstances. She fought as hard as she could. But eventually, she had to agree to Emperor Charles V to give him Burgundy, which he had an ancestral claim on through his grandmother, Mary the Rich. Yeah.
Oh.
And after a year of grueling negotiations, Louise agreed to not only hand over Burgundy, but also to exchange Francis as a prisoner for his two eldest sons, the Dauphin and the Duke of Orléans.
Oh.
Yeah. So Francis is forced to sign this treaty under duress in Madrid. It's called the Treaty of Madrid. And then he is sent home. But because Francis was basically forced to sign this treaty, he didn't see it as valid. So as soon as he gets back to France, while the sons do get handed over, they get like handed over at the border, the empire hasn't managed to secure Burgundy. So Francis simply then refuses to give up Burgundy once he gets back to France. And he's like, no, we're going to renegotiate this. We're going to get a better deal. Now, this led to a further breakdown in relations between Francis and the empire. And eventually, Francis and Charles V, the emperor, hated each other so much that they refused to even contemplate negotiating a peace.
Wow.
So Louise had to step in once again.
Mummy Dearest to the rescue.
Mummy Dearest has to step in, as did Auntie Dearest on Charles's side, because the 1529 Treaty of Cambrai happens, and the negotiations are headed by two women, Louise of Savoy on the French side, and...
Catherine?
Not Catherine of Aragon, but that would be cool. No, Margaret of Austria on the other side. If you remember Margaret of Austria, she was raised at the French court to become the bride of Charles VIII before he basically threw her over in favour of Anne of Brittany and cut off the Habsburg ties from the French royal family.
Oh, yeah.
So Margaret, after being raised at the French court in Amboise, was sent packing back home as a teenager. But this did mean that Louise and Margaret had both grown up together at Amboise. So they go way back. They
knew each
other.
Childhood friends.
Like, they went to school together, you know.
While
they're not besties, they have a lot in common. They've had the same education, basically. And Margaret is also a very powerful woman at this point.
Nice.
At this point, she is the widowed Duchess of Savoy. So she's actually also a sister-in-law for Louise.
Hey.
And she's also been appointed as governor of the Netherlands.
Hmm.
So she is quite powerful in her own right.
Yeah.
And the negotiations go very well. So France ended up securing the release of Francis's sons whilst still keeping hold of Burgundy.
Wow.
But there were sacrifices made.
Yeah, I want that.
France agreed to respect the Habsburgs' right to rule over Italy. So Milan and Naples are now controlled by the Habsburgs at this point. Also, they have to pay a huge indemnity to the empire. They have to pay a lot of money.
Yeah, of course, no surprise. You know, I could just imagine, though, those two women giving, like, their respective, like, son or, like, nephew a slap on the back of the head and being like, let me show you how it's done. And they go into the room and they come out and they're like, we've signed this already. Put your name on it.
Yeah, this although neither of them were at the negotiations. They both refused to show up. So it's purely...
Well, they went back home and gave them a slap.
Like, they're not even signing anything. Like, Louise is given regency powers in order to do this. So Francis doesn't even sign the treaty. It's just Louise. And as a result, this is known as the Ladies' Peace.
Nice.
That's what this treaty is called. Also, as part of this piece, Francis is married to Charles V's sister, Eleanor, because Claude has died at this point.
Aww.
Nobody at the French court really likes Eleanor Eleanor Habsburg, unfortunately.
Well, it was kind of forced marriage there.
But this did mean that there was a peace that endured for a whopping 7 years, which is quite long for a peace in this period. And in addition, France was at peace with England for 14 years as well.
What?
Which is a tall order considering Henry VIII at this point is in the process of breaking away from the Catholic Church in order to marry Anne Boleyn.
True.
But again, we'll get to that later. Get to that next episode. But this is Louise's last great act as the great regent. Because sadly, in September 1531, the plague struck Paris.
Santé, Bourbon!
Yeah, we still got plague, unfortunately.
Come on, there's like bubonic in the US now. Running
there. There is. Although the plague that people usually died of in this period, it was the pneumonic plague.
Yeah.
Which is more, you know, it's the same bacterial infection, but it's more easily spread between people. It's more contagious. So despite her attempt to flee to the country, Louise of Savoy succumbed quickly to the pestilence.
Well, at the same time, it's like, oh, Lisa was succumbed quickly, not drawn out.
Yeah, and she died at the Chateau of Grez-sur-Loing.
Aged?
Ooh, good question. She was 55 years old.
Ooh.
Which is all right.
She's younger than my mother.
She's lived longer than Louis XII, Anne of Brittany, Charles VIII, not as long as Louis XI, but, you know, she's had a good run by the standards of the time.
She's seen a few people come and go.
Yes. And even though she was never officially a queen, Louise was buried in the style of a queen in the Basilica of Saint-Denis. And I couldn't find an image of her tomb, so I assume it doesn't survive, but I may be wrong. So, us having covered Louise's life, let's get into rating her.
Yes.
Shall we?
Enchanté.
So, as a historical figure, Louise is perhaps not as well known and maybe didn't have as dramatic a life as her rival Anne of Brittany, but she has just as many depictions and praise from her time, if not more, since she was around longer. So I will send you, first of all, I'll send you a couple images from when she's younger. Her and her husband's mini court in Angoulême had its own sort of vibrant atmosphere, and a lot of manuscripts were produced at this court, some of which depict Louise. There's one picture I really like.
She's playing chess.
Yeah, it's by the artist Robin A. Testard, and it shows Louise with her husband next to her playing a game of chess.
I like how it's that she's the one playing chess, not like the husband.
Yeah, he's like, he's kind of egging her on. He's like, go, you got this. you got this, girl.
She's like, yeah, I do.
And the dog is supporting her as well. And this is from a manuscript called Les Échecs Amoureux, which means the lover's chess. And it's a book of love poetry by Evrard de Conti, who was a popular writer of the time. So she's got all these like artist writers, intellectuals at the Angoulême court. And this manuscript was dedicated to Louise of Savoy.
Nice.
So chess is just starting to become a big thing in France, the big new thing, originating in India.
Yeah.
But it was popularized in France in the 16th century. And at the court of Louise and her daughter Marguerite as well, is where the queen started to become the most powerful piece.
Hey.
Coincidence?
I think not.
There is another really cool image from the same manuscript showing Louise playing a dulcimer, which is like a stringed instrument. And she's got a couple swans next to her.
Yeah. Nice, because when you play some instruments, you get some swans around you.
But you can see during her marriage, she's wearing these like extravagant gowns.
Yeah, and that headdresses.
Yeah, and she's got some extravagant headdresses. She's wearing bright colours as well. She's wearing bright red. But this does change when she becomes a widow. She's expected to dress quite differently. And she becomes iconic for her very demure black outfit.
Morning look.
And so this should be the episode image. This is a portrait by Jean Clouet, and we'll start seeing the name Clouet a lot as Jean and his son Francois were both the main court painters of their times. And they painted just about every single member of the French royal family in the 16th century. So we'll be seeing their portraits loads. Together, they're essentially kind of like the Hans Holbein of France. So you know how Hans Holbein just like paints everyone.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's a coincidence that Jean Clouet first appears almost immediately after France the First Reign begins. He's definitely one of these people that Louise brings in.
Yeah.
And once again, we're seeing a move towards realism in portraiture.
Yeah.
And future Clouet portraits will be more colourful and vibrant than this one. But in this one, Louise is... You wouldn't really think she was the Queen Mother of France. With how modestly she's dressed.
Yeah, it just looks like almost like a nun or something.
She looks like a nun, yeah. She's got this like simple black dress.
No black bling bling hood. Anywhere.
She's got a wimple that comes all the way down over her eyebrows.
Yeah.
But if you look very closely at the kind of fabric, it's very like rich.
Mm.
But yeah, this is all because of the fact that Louise is a widow. And she's like, you know.
Yeah, no more fun colours for me.
She's quite restrained about it. But we do see her pop up quite a lot in manuscripts of the time.
Nice.
There is this one manuscript depiction I really like where she is shown with a giant like compass needle directing the young Francis.
Francis
is depicted with a dolphin next to him to show that he's the Dauphin.
God, the animals back in the day.
Louise is guiding him with this giant symbolic compass, like the compass that you use to like draw circles, that kind of
compass. In school.
And we've also got a depiction of Louise presiding over a meeting of the Estates General.
Flanked
by the great biblical heroines Susanna and Esther either side of her. And if you remember, women aren't really allowed in the Estates General officially. So she's kind of breaking the mold here. And if you look very closely at this depiction, she is wearing her black gown, but underneath, it, as she peels back the sleeve, it's got some ermine fur. Yeah, some ermine trim. So she's definitely rich. Don't let the black deceive you. So we've got lots of depictions like this. I'll put more on the WordPress as well. Louise's personal motto was Libris et Liberis, books and children.
Straightforward.
And this emphasizes her passion for education. This is actually Lorenzo the Magnificent's motto, Lorenzo de' Medici. And like many in France in the time, Louise admired the genius of the Italians, and she's emulating that sort of culture, the Renaissance. And she helps continue the Valois tradition we've seen of being an absolute nerd. She loves books. She loves collecting books. She loves distributing books. She loves, you know, sponsoring printing presses. And Louise believed in a holistic education. Where, so she molded Francis into the quintessential Renaissance man. So he's like both an intellectual and is very good at all, like the hunting and the jousting and the all that sort of thing.
A proper man.
So the writer Fleuranges said, quote, "No lord ever had more pastimes, nor was better instructed than Francis." And he attributed this instruction solely to Louise.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So Louise instilled in Francis the idea from a young age that he was destined for greatness and heroism. When he was 10, she made a medal for him that had his face on one side and a flaming salamander on the other. So the salamander was actually Louise's personal badge before it was Francis's. Francis then adopts it as his personal badge.
Why a salamander?
Well, it was believed at the time that salamanders were impervious to damage. They're invincible. Which is why the salamanders are always depicted like in, like, engulfed in flames. And like it's like, you know, even it's fire can't harm me.
Little blobs.
And Francis certainly lived much of his life as though he were invincible. He was always getting into scrapes. So I think we can give Louise quite a bit of credit for sort of shaping the kingly image of Francis. I hesitate to call it like reflected glory from Francis because really it's she's playing a big part in like molding Francis' image as well as her own. So I think she should get a lot of credit in this category. So that's Enchanté. What do we... what do you want to give her?
I like her contributions and she's got a good depiction. Other people admired her at the time. And I think she was pretty good. I want to give her quite high. I'm thinking like 8. What are you thinking? A bit lower? Maybe I do 7.
Yeah, I'm thinking like a 7. I think it's like, it's something that's sort of groundbreaking.
True.
I do like that she introduces the Clouets to the French court, the painter.
I'll do 7 then.
But yeah, I think it's 7. I think it's about on par with Louis XII last episode.
Yeah.
Who also got 7 from each of us. Also, I'm very mindful of leaving room for further, for future rulers in this category.
Yeah, true.
7's good. She definitely invests in this category, I think.
Yeah.
So that is a 7 from each of us, which is 14 for Enchanté. So moving on to En Garde.
En Garde.
Louise very much took after her childhood guardian, Anne of France, when it came to what a ruthless power player she could be. She had no shame about using her son to wedge herself into the royal court, and at certain points even threatened to usurp Anne of Brittany's place as the first woman in France, especially when Anne of Brittany went into her exile. So you could, of course, argue that France's inheriting the throne came down to dumb luck. A lot of convenient deaths had to happen to get him there.
Very true.
And unless you think that, you know, Louise was killing everyone, which she was not, Louise didn't have much to do with this. But because of the prophecy of his birth, Louise did everything she could to make the transition as smooth as possible and to, like, pave the way for Francis, for her little Caesar to become... the most special boy in the world. You know, by pushing Francis into the spotlight as the king's heir, she's very much laying the groundwork for a smooth transition of power, I think.
No, it's civil unrest happening.
Yeah, exactly. So Louise is doing all the networking for him. She's making friends and influencing people. I think she did an A-plus job at this. She then, immediately when Francis takes the throne, he goes off to war. He wins a great victory. Louise is left in charge. Everything goes really well in her regency. So it's A-plus. Problems come later in her second regency, where it's very much the struggle bus.
Not her fault having a son get captured.
It is not her fault. And she did really, really well at navigating this as well. But it was a much more uphill battle this second time. But yeah, I think it's hard to overemphasize the extent to which Louise was in charge, like, when she was alive.
Yeah.
She basically fulfills the regent or, like, semi-regent, like, sort of co-ruler role, basically all the way up until her death.
Yeah.
It's only after her death in 1531 that Francis really becomes a fully independent ruler. But even then, he's still taking lots of advice from his sister, Marguerite. Mm. Also, it's because of Louise's claim for Bourbon, which she pursues, that the last great prince within France is kind of brought down.
Mm.
And France is on its way to being, like, fully centralized. There are no other very powerful Capetian princes to have to deal with. There are some, you know, minor principalities around the place. There's other duchies. Yeah. Like, there's the Dukes of Vendôme. There's the Dukes of Lorraine as well.
Quite
powerful. But in terms of huge, chunky territory that takes up, like, a third of France, Bourbon is the last one.
Yeah.
And it's brought down in part thanks to Louise. And yeah, Francis, you know, his reign is very much, at least his early reign, is very much a golden age for France. And Louise is, you know, has her
alive then.
Hands on the steering wheel throughout that point, throughout that time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, what would we like to give for On Guard?
Not low, but it's not high. It's just like meh, meh, meh.
A lot of it is stuff falling into her lap.
Yeah.
But she does make the most of it.
Yeah, but it's like...
Like, she's taking advantage of, like, every little crumb of power that
but
she has.
But it's all for her son.
I suppose, yeah.
At the end of the day, it isn't her being like, mine! It's like, mine for my son.
That is true. But at the same time, she does have a lot of power in her own right. And she isn't shy about, like, taking that power. She's not stepping aside and, like, fully just letting Francis do whatever he wants. She's, like, literally no major policy that happens in France. Like, no major decision that Francis makes.
It's about consulting her.
Doesn't go through his mother.
Yeah.
It's like, yes, there's what she says she's doing is, like, oh, everything's
for my son,
for Francis. Which, like, it is. She does care about him. But,
it's also for her.
Ultimately, a lot of the decisions being made are actually her decisions. And people are very aware of this. And a lot of people commentate on this. And a lot of people are mad about it.
True. But I don't think it's high.
I think it's high. I don't think it's the highest.
Yeah. Like, I'm thinking like a 6.
6?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm slightly more impressed. I might go 7. Maybe 8. I don't know.
Let's stick with 6.
I'm going to go 7.5.
When in doubt, go in the middle.
Yeah. So that's a 13.5 for On Guard.
Okay.
So moving on to Voulez-vous.
Voulez-vous?
So we've talked about Louise being a great cultural patron, which is sort of the usual role of women at the royal court. But in Voulez-vous, the thing that makes Louise really stand out is her role as a peacemaker.
Okay.
So Henry VIII's chief advisor, Cardinal Wolsey, describes her as, quote, the mother and nourisher of peace.
Ooh.
And Louise always positions herself as kind of like the angel on Francis's shoulder. So he's got all these military men on one side telling him to go in, like, charge in, like, be this big, you know, bravado kind of king. And Louise is kind of on the other side saying, you know, remember your honor, remember your duty, remember, you know, your piety.
A bloody king.
Yeah. She could be an advocate for war at times. For example, she strongly supported Francis in his Italian invasion. And she was involved in raising armies to defend France while he was imprisoned. But you could argue this was out of necessity.
Yeah.
Like, Francis couldn't let Milan alone now. Like, that they would lose face if they lost Milan. So it was kind of considered a necessity that they get Mulan back.
Yeah.
But Louise taught Francis, and he kind of followed through on this, that whenever he could to seek a peaceful resolution to anything. And even when you see Francis campaigning, he always tries to negotiate before charging in and, you know, getting captured, which he eventually does. But he always seeks the peaceful option first, and that is...
Yeah.
Was very much Mother's reflective influence. Of Louise's policy, yeah. So Louise's perhaps greatest skill was her negotiation skill.
Yeah.
So she used her feminine charm and considerable network of allies, both inside and out the kingdom, to do this. She was one of the leading figures in a negotiation called the Concordat of Bologna, which is a negotiation with the Medici Pope, Leo X, to resolve the dispute between the king and the pope over the pragmatic sanction of Bourges, which has been a problem for a while. It's basically the thing where, like, the king is like, liberty for the French clergy, and the pope is like, no, they have to pay taxes. And under the Concordat, this whole dispute, which has been happening for the last 100 years, is finally resolved. So the French clergy will resume paying taxes to the pope. But Francis will have more of a say over who gets appointed to offices in France, and the clergy that get appointed will have the option of giving, quote, gifts to the king.
I don't think that's an option.
Yeah. So the Concordat was sort of Louise's thing, and it did anger Francis's advisors in the Parlement and the University of Paris. They saw Louise as overstepping and going against the people's will. This is a common complaint that men had against her.
Of course.
Louise was also scapegoated for the sometimes ruinous amount that she and Francis spent on his ostentatious lifestyle. Both their ostentatious lifestyles. And there was some truth to this. Louise had an unnecessarily humongous household staff of 240. That's 240 people serving one woman. And she spent exorbitant amounts doing up her various residences. So the Louvre and Fontainebleau Palace at this time were demolished in favor of more spacious, opulent, modern palaces. Wow. But, you know, we can't criticize the king for reckless spending. It's the woman's fault.
It's always the woman.
Yeah. So Louise maybe unfairly bore the brunt of these complaints, but she did nonetheless play a role in all of this. And to finance a lot of this, she was involved in increasingly corrupt financial dealings.
Ooh.
Yeah, during Francis's reign. The level of control that she had in France meant that she was not innocent in any of this, you know? She definitely had her fingers in all the pies. Some see her as a peacemaker. Others see her as this overly greedy, avaricious, ambitious woman. But, you know, the two things can be true at the same time, I think.
Yeah.
Also, one of Louise's greatest diplomatic victories was during the Second Regency.
Okay.
When, you know, France was in very desperate times. Louise actually appealed to none other than the Ottoman Sultan, Suleiman the Magnificent.
Wow.
For military aid against the empire.
She went to the Ottomans. Damn. That's ballsy.
Yeah, so at this point, the empire, which is unified with Spain and Naples as well, is humongous. And, like, France and the Ottomans are basically on either side of it. So they decide to team up. Yeah.
Wow.
As a result of Louise's negotiation, this is the first time that the Ottomans are seen not as like an Eastern boogeyman, but as like an actual, you know, political entity.
Yeah. That
you can have like diplomatic dealings with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, equals, I guess.
Louise isn't beating the crusade drum. She's reaching across the aisle.
Well, she's like, I'm surrounded. I need to go somewhere else to get my help.
Yeah, exactly. Because you've also got England being allied to the
empire. Yeah, well, she's basically being surrounded.
Yeah. So this was very widely criticized at the time, as you can imagine.
Oh, yeah, would have been. They were like, you're siding with the heathens and the blah, 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 blah.
There were actually Ottoman mercenaries on French shores at one point. This is a bit later in Francis' reign, but yeah. But Louis kind of kicks off these negotiations, which eventually leads to Francis getting his courtiers educated in Arabic so that they can talk to the Ottoman diplomats.
Which you think about is pretty amazing considering, like, you know, the in Spain and there's the whole, you know,
the Inquisition. Yeah.
Yeah. Just like, it's kind of almost like, you know, pointing your finger out at them, being like, F you.
Yeah, this is not long after the last Muslims in Spain are, like, forcibly converted. It's also very ironic since Louis and France are very much against the Protestant Reformation that's happened. So it's like, within France, they're persecuting any religious difference. But in the meantime, they're actually doing diplomatic dealings with the complete, you know, completely different religion. It's all a means to an end.
True, true.
It's all about being pragmatic for Louis.
What did the Ottomans get out of it? Like trade or something?
They got their first ally in Western Europe. And trade helps as well. But you know, the Habsburgs are scary for them as well. The Habsburgs are humongous.
Oh, yeah.
They're at the height of their power.
Yeah, they got Charles.
Yeah, it's the enemy of my enemy is my friend. That's what they're both getting out of it. Yeah. So yeah, Louis pioneers cooperation between Western Europe and the Middle East, which I think is...
nice.
A very new thing.
Yeah.
So that is Voulez-Vous.
Okay, she'll get some points for that.
Big points for diplomacy.
Yeah, big points
Less points for...
Points for extravagance. Yeah. Over extravagance. Are the people getting taxed heavily from her luxuries?
Yes.
See, that's the thing. I wouldn't want to live there then. I would not want to live under that, paying a ton of taxes so we can get her bloody son out of prison and get her palaces built. I would not be happy with that.
So what do you want to give?
She lowers down a bit for that, thinking like a 5.
Yeah, I was kind of thinking of 5 as well. It kind of cancels it out.
Like, the only thing she gets good really is, like, that Ottomans and stuff, because that's also bringing, like, new things into France. Like, I'm sure the Ottomans would give, like, you know, their delicious spices.
Yeah, so 5 and 5, so that is a 10 for Voulez-Vous. Right in the middle. Now moving on to Ooh La La.
Yes. Ooh La La.
So Louise, as you can imagine, was quite a scandalous figure. Yeah. Her control,
a powerful woman.
The level of control she had over French affairs was highly controversial in her time, especially since she never actually held the rank of queen.
True.
So the Parliament and the University of Paris in particular took umbrage at her level of influence, thought that it undermined the will of the French people.
If it was a man, I doubt they'd say that.
Yeah. Aside from her rumoured love affair with Saint-Germain, there is not much sauciness in Louise of Savoy's life. Although there is a little in relation to her daughter.
Oh.
So Marguerite, she continued to live at the French court even after her marriage. She was married to the Duke of Alençon, who was a prince of the realm. But she was very unhappy with this marriage. They didn't have any children. So Louise actually encouraged... Marguerite to take a lover.
Oh.
Maybe as an alternative way of having children.
I guess she also, if you think about it, she kind of grew up, like, you know, she was really good friends with those mistresses, which is unconventional for the time.
Yeah, Louise has a very flexible approach to ethics, which is quite different from the women we've seen previously. So Louise encouraged the Admiral of France, a guy called Bonnivet, to to sail into Marguerite's port, as it were.
Oh my god! Oh. That was a great analogy.
He was the Admiral, I had to use that.
That was really good. I applaud you for that.
But Marguerite was more scrupulous than her mother. She was determined to keep her virtue. And after more than one instance of Bonnivet breaking into her chambers, she confronted her mother for encouraging him.
It was like, stop sending him to me.
Whereupon Louise scolded Marguerite for not accepting his advances, and she told Marguerite to be more agreeable.
God, so, you never hear that where someone's like, yeah. A mother's actually like, go get a lover, get a lover.
Exactly. So it's not great. It's not a great parenting moment for Louise, I don't think, especially by the standards of the time.
Marguerite, though, she stuck firm in her
beliefs. She did, yeah.
But that, oh my God.
So yeah, Louise has very flexible morals. I think that's worthy of some ooh la la points.
Yeah, that is. Sending a lover to your own daughter, or attempted lover.
Yeah.
Potential one.
We've also got the shenanigans with the Marshal de Gier, all the drama around the custody of Francis.
Chasing that soldier.
It's chasing the soldier down the halls. The extravagant early life of Louise with her court with all these mistresses.
Yeah.
Very.
And bringing them with her when she moved to court too.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's worthy of.
I think 3.
Yeah, I'd give it a bit higher.
Maybe 4.
I might give it a 5.
Maybe 4. Point for mistress, point for soldier, point for daughter. And I think there was a point for something else.
For being a power-hungry woman?
No.
I'm giving her a point for that because it was scandalous at the time. She was very, like, overt and shameless about her power-hungry. You could also give a point for the Ottomans. That was considered scandalous very much at the time.
I'm going to stick a 4.
Okay, I'm going to do I might even do a 6. I'm being a lot more generous than you are, which is weird considering you're always more generous with women. This seems to be the exception.
I know, but this just isn't like juicy ooh-la-la for me.
Okay. It's more like stuff that people clutch their pearls about at the time, but is not necessarily stuff that we would consider reprehensible.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to stick
you
with
can
a
go
5.
If you... Yeah, I'm sticking with my 4s.
No, actually, I'm doing a 6. I'm doing a 6.
Okay.
I just think this is just a little bit that much more scandalous. So that is a 10 for ooh la la.
Oh, I remember what the 4th point was for. For the lover that she potentially had.
Ah, yes.
The Fion Throne.
Let's get into the reign.
Yes.
Now, in terms of her regency, it's hard to say in terms of like exact dates. There are 3 points where she served as regent. So we've got... 1515 to 1516, 1523 to 1526, and also briefly in 1529 when she's doing the treaty, the ladies' peace.
Okay.
So let's round that to about 4 years in total. Okay. And there's a score of 0.93.
Ooh.
But Louise also had personal territory, and we said we'd count. So we'd start counting personal territory. We did it for Anne of France. So she was made Duchess of Angoulême in her own right by the king about a month after his accession on the 4th of February, 1515. And she ruled over a rapidly accumulating territory, which came to include the regions of Anjou and Auvergne until her death on the 22nd of September, 1531. So overall, that's 16 years, 7 months and 18 days. And... That's going to be her, like, half score for her territory. Chop in half. So that's an extra 1.55 points. So that's overall 2.5 points for Louise's reign. It's not spectacular.
Okay. Yeah.
Now, Louise has 2 children. And we'll be giving episodes to both of them. So, Francis will be next episode, of course. And I'm working on a Patreon episode for Marguerite as well, because she needs one. She's very significant, especially since she's one of Francis's principal advisors, especially after his mother's death. And she becomes renowned as one of the most intelligent and beautiful women of her time. She becomes an accomplished writer and a highly sought after marriage prospect, as you can imagine. So at first she's married unhappily to the Duke of Alençon. And also, by the way, as far as I can tell, the Valois of Alençon, you know, before Francis has his children, they're next in line to the throne.
No.
Louise is like, if Francis dies, then Marguerite becomes queen because she's married to the next in line.
My bloodline's still continuing.
Yeah, so you can see what she's done there.
Smart.
But Alençon dies, they don't have any children, so Marguerite remarries to King Henry II of Navarre. Which is why she's often known as Marguerite of Navarre. She had one daughter, Queen Joan III of Navarre.
Of course, Joan.
Of course, Joan. And through Joan, she actually ends up being an ancestor of the Bourbon dynasty. legitimacy that rules after Francis's has died out. So Marguerite's descendants actually end up lasting longer than Francis do on the French throne, ironically, interestingly. But I won't get too much further into that. We'll get to that later. And I'll save that for Marguerite's Patreon episode.
Yes.
So Louise has the unique honour of a 100% survival rate for her children.
What?
She only has two babies.
And damn. They both survive. Nice. Good on her.
So that is 3.38 points for the children. It's a total Vion Throne score of 5.86 out of 20.
Nice. And the grand total?
The grand total is 53.4.
Okay.
Which is slightly lower than Louis XII's last episode. So she's not done as well as Anne of Brittany, who got 72.
Yeah.
I think she, we'll see what seating she deserves. Eliza, do you think she, she's not nosebleed section. We know that.
Yeah, she's not nosebleed section.
I think the question is whether she deserves to be VIP. In the best of the with the best of the best in the VIP box, or if she's nice and in the middle, upper middle in Economy Plus.
I'm kind of leaning towards Economy Plus.
Yeah, when I started my research, I was kind of like, it's going to be kind of boring. She's going to be Economy Plus. But then when I got really into my research, I was like, oh, she's really interesting, actually. I think she could be VIP. But now having done all of her scores and really, like, kind of taken a step back and looked at it all.
Yeah, I'm like, it's not quite there.
She is a great woman of French history. She's known as the Great Regent.
Yes, she is. Yeah. But is she like Fredegund, drinking buddies? Like,
she's a little bit too, I don't know.
Doesn't have that oomph.
It's all for her special little boy.
Yeah.
He's the most important thing.
Well, you definitely, with the other women, they definitely felt a bit more like, it's for me.
Yeah. Like, Anne of Brittany was all about her.
Yeah.
Anne of France, all about her.
Yeah. I'm going to go Economy Plus.
Yeah. Economy Plus?
Yeah.
Okay.
Is that, like, our first lady in Economy Plus?
No. We've got others.
Other ladies?
Yeah. So she's joining during the first Navarre and during the second Navarre. Anne of Kiev, Geburga of Saxony.
Wow, we've got loads in there. I think I just always remember Fredegund and assume everyone else is in VIP. So I'm like, Fredegund.
Yeah, so there's a few other people there. Other women who were regents of France or rulers in their own right, but weren't necessarily the most impressive.
Yeah.
But also don't deserve to sit in the nosebleed section with Bozo.
Yeah, but can't quite make it to being Fredegund's drinking buddy.
Exactly.
You need a special spark for that.
So that is Louise of Savoy. I think she'll be disappointed that she didn't make it into VIP, especially since she idolized Blanche of Castile, who is in VIP.
Oh, can you just imagine her, like, on the, like, VIP, like, you know, has, like, a... It's on the other side of the aisle, and she's just longingly looking over at Blanche, being like, oh.
And then she sees Anne of Brittany there, and she's like, damn it!
Yeah.
Yeah, so, So Louise won in life, but Anne wins in death.
Yes, definitely. Okay, I just imagine Anne looking at her and smirking.
So that is Louise of Savoy. Next episode on the main feed, we'll be doing the big man himself, Francis I.
Woo!
But meanwhile, in the boudoir, next week, we're doing his first mistress, Ooh. Françoise de Foix. And we'll be learning about what she's been doing this whole time in the background.
How's she been mistressing?
Yeah, so join Patreon for the much-awaited continuation of our Mistress series, and I'm looking forward to playing our Mistress theme song again.
Yay!
All right, so with all that said, that's going to be more of a while from me.
Goodbye from me.